The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
When you begin to talk about halakha, about law, there are words that pop into our minds. Dry, technical, boring. That's usually the way we think of a system of law. As a matter of fact, when you think about a code of Jewish law, it seems so imposing. And yet I chose this as one of the books to take a look at. I think I may be mistaken that this is our last in the series of Jewish books. You can imagine that it's not the last in the series of Jewish books. And I want to give you a picture of why this book is so special, and of why the Jewish people have such a deep, emotional, philosophical, and not just intellectual relationship with this book. But to do this, I have to tell you a little bit about the author. I'll be honest with you, I don't know if we'll get into a textual study. But at least to give you a feeling, a flavor, of what it means when you meet a Jew who asks a question on halacha. And I want you to know that, you know, everybody has their system of study. To me, what motivates me in study is a good question. I mean, we've discussed this already. And so I want to tell you the question that is behind this class. When you begin to study halacha, you know, for example, if a student comes in off the street and they want to find out a little bit about Judaism. So normally you might think, you know, if it's an incredible system, so what difference what class they come into, right? And what difference what book they open? Go to a Jewish library, open any book, and you'll see it's beautiful, right? No, not so true. Because you have to first have a little background to appreciate what it is you see. And I'll give you an example. So what do we think of when we think of Jewish halacha, Jewish law? How does one have an obligation to believe? We discussed that in Maimonides. That's very difficult. Or what does it mean that I make kiddush on Friday night? That the law tells me, Jewish code of law of halacha, tells me, make kiddush, sanctify wine. What does that mean? So we'll talk about that a little bit, Bezrat Hashem on Shabbat, but that's a halachic question. And so I would imagine, on the one hand, you know, what does it mean that there are two loaves of bread that I eat Friday night? And how majestic that is, and how magnificent vis-a-vis its relationship with the partnership I'm supposed to have with God. But when I open up a book of halacha, I find a lot of seemingly trivial, nonsensical details. Should you cut your fingernails on Thursday? I mean, who cares? Well, if you don't cut your fingernails until Friday, is that more respectful for Shabbat? And some of the questions are so absurd. If I want to make a cup of tea on Shabbos, so why am I making a cup of tea? I'm making a cup of tea because it brings me pleasure, and it's Shabbat, and I want to have pleasure on Shabbat. Well, you don't make a cup of tea this way, you make it that way. And you'll find that, halachically speaking, you take a cup, and if you've got a kettle that boiled on the fire, so you take the kettle, and you pour it into another cup. And then you take from that cup, and you pour it into a third cup. And then you put the tea bag in, and they'll tell you, well, don't pour the water on the tea bag. And if you put it straight into one cup, well, then you shouldn't drink it. And, you know, it's a, what you call the give-me-a-break philosophy. I mean, well, what is all this? So, if you're lucky, you'll meet someone who'll explain this to you, and they'll say, well, you know, there's a provision we don't cook on Shabbat. And that makes a lot of sense. When I cook something, I'm producing something. It's a part of my creative activity during the week. One day a week I remember that I'm not the creator, I'm created, and that's very valuable. So if you think about it, tea is a food substance. And if I pour boiling water on a tea bag, I'm cooking the tea. So how do I ensure that I'm not cooking the tea bag? I remove it from its original source of heat to the extent that it won't cook. Okay, so I can understand that up here, right? Logically. What about in here? Hey, what is that? What is the Jewish fascination with detail? And why are we so preoccupied with the minute? So in order to appreciate that, I want to give you a perspective on the code of Jewish law. On who wrote it, on who this person was, and on how this system, this book, became so meaningful to the Jewish people. Now the author was a person by the name of Yosef Karo, K-A-R-O. Yosef Karo, very interesting fellow. He was born in 1475, and he lived until 1540. I'm going back a stage. He was born actually in 1488. The reason I said 1475 is because that was when his Rebbe was born. And the truth is, I can't really tell you about Rav Yosef Karo until I tell you about his teacher. His teacher was a guy named Rav Yaakov. And by the way, you should know that this could be a never-ending story. I mean, how could you understand Rashi unless you who lived 1040 to 1105, unless you understood who his teacher was? The Rif, Rav Yitzchak Alfasi, was one of the greatest authorities of his day. And how could you understand the Rif if you didn't understand the Gaonic period that he came from? And how could you understand the Gaonim if you didn't realize that they came from the Rabbanan Sabarai in the 7th century? And how could you understand them without realizing they were the grandchildren of the people who edited the Talmud? And how could you understand them if you didn't understand that they studied in the academies that were created by the students of the authorities who wrote the Mishnah? And of course, how could you understand, etc. In fact, whenever I teach history, this is always the problem. Where do you start from?
Yeah.
I mean, right?
It's like we know Ramban, but we don't know his teacher. So
that's right, that's exactly right.
If he went past his
I'll tell you when I had this. Pardon?
Does he take what his teacher taught him and make it into even? He was even more prolific, or like why?
Well, I'm not even going to answer that question because that will take us off on such a tangent that we only have an hour. But I will tell you that certainly we try to break down a topic into its unit, and of course we realize we're not living in a vacuum. And it's like when I teach the Exodus of Egypt here. How can you possibly understand the Exodus from Egypt unless you understand what they did in Egypt? And how can you understand what they did in Egypt unless you understand how they got there? So you really have to start with the story of Joseph and his brothers. And how could you possibly understand Joseph and his brothers without understanding who their father was, Yaakov? And of course, Yaakov comes from Isaac, who comes from Abraham. And how could you understand Avram if you didn't realize his relationship? And we just talked about this with Noach. And how could you talk about Noach if you didn't begin to realize that Noach was the second opportunity to make right what Adam failed at doing? And of course, how could you understand Adam without understanding why the world was created? And how could you understand how the world was created without understanding God? So in order to teach Jewish history, you have to teach about God. So where do you get the Jewish history? So the 40-year Jewish history begins tomorrow, but you understand my problem. However, in this particular case, we really need to take a look at the Rebbe of the Shulchan Aruch, of Rav Yosef Karo. Rav Yaakov Bey Rav was born in 1475. And the fact, Yaakov the son of Rav, he lived in Spain, and at the age of 17, one of the most profound events in Jewish history occurred, which changed the face, the destiny, the direction of the entire Jewish people and of Torah as well. And that was the exile from Spain. On one day, really the space of a week, the entire Jewish community of Spain, which was certainly the center of world Jewry at the time, was exiled. They were actually not exiled. They were told that they could stay if they wished to convert to Christianity. 250,000 of them, which is the overwhelming majority, chose not to. And they left. They left by land and by sea, in boats, and on foot, and on muleback. And this caused them eventually to be spread over the entire world. As a matter of fact, I'll tell you something very interesting, which is a fascinating detail. You know, how you look at history always depends on your perspective. It's very difficult to come up with objective history. There's a mystical idea, which I can tell you, and I can share an example of with you, but I don't know that I can explain it to you. But there's a mystical idea that says that within the root of every destruction is the seed of redemption. When you look at an event that's incredibly destructive, you may not see it. Somewhere within that destruction is the seed of redemption. This is one of the best examples I can think of. The exile from Spain occurred on the 3rd of August in 1492. That was the date that was given as the decree. It was, coincidentally or not coincidentally, depending on your perspective, actually also the 9th of Av, which is the day that Jews mourn the destruction of the temple. There's an idea in the Talmud that every time the Jews carry on another stage of their exile, the temple is destroyed anew. The temple of Spanish Jewry was destroyed on the 3rd of August in 1492. Coincidence? I don't know. What's more fascinating to me is that that very day is the day that we know that the Nina, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria set sail for America. And when the Jews were exiled from Spain, the overwhelming majority of them ended up in Europe, and in Eastern Europe. In fact, that's how the communities got to Poland, to Eastern Russia, from the exile in Spain. That's how in the Khmelnytsky massacres in the 17th century, most of world Jewry was in Eastern Russia and Poland. And so on the very day that the exile would cause the overwhelming majority of Jews to end up in Europe, to begin a sojourn there, to some extent, that would last nearly 500 years, and that would end so tragically as we know, on that very day, three boats set sail, which according to legend, and again, I don't know if this is true, it doesn't really matter to me, may have well carried some Jews with them, set sail for the New World, for the land of America that would eventually become a Jewish community that would be the haven which would save world Jewry when the European world Jewry disappeared. That's a fascinating idea. As a matter of fact, I'll go you one further. And I tell you all this because you have to understand that this is going to relate to the mindset of Rav Yosef Karo when he wrote his books. This is not a tangent. In 1882, or I should say in 1881, there were approximately something to the tune of 100,000 Jews in America. 130. In 1882, the Russian Tsar Alexander was assassinated. The Tsarist authorities looking for a scapegoat blamed it on the Jews, and they began a series of state-sponsored pogroms. What does it mean that there's a state-sponsored pogrom? It doesn't mean that the state gets the army together and goes and starts a pogrom. It means that they let everybody know that on a certain day, a week hence, the police commissar and all the policemen are going to be out of town. And when they see the notice up, the Jews know that that week there's going to be a pogrom. If the economic situation is so bad, if the political unrest is so bad, if you can divert the attention of the people and blame it on the Jews, in the 30 years, the pogroms, you know, most famous of all, of course, is the Kishinev pogrom, the Bayless Kishinev trial. In the 30 years between 1882 and World War I, 2.2 million Jews migrated from Eastern Europe. It is the largest single migration of Jews in world history. It's an unbelievable movement of people when you think about it. Almost 2 million of them end up in America. A trickle, maybe 30,000 of them, end up in Israel. There was a famous shipping company. And you don't have to take a course. You can just read a book to see these things. They're unbelievable. There's a famous shipping company that actually was based in Bremen, in Germany, that made fortunes by charging Jews money for this passage. And they had to get their way to Germany, get on a boat, and travel to America. The trip could cost as much as $30 a person. The stories of these trips were unbelievable. What the Jewish people had to go through, the hardships that they went through to get to America, was quite incredible. There's a magnificent book, it's called World of Our Fathers by Irving Howe. It's written from a very secular perspective, but he shares anecdotes of the stories of our ancestors, these Jews who came to America through Ellis Island. It says, for example, there was a doctor that would sit at Ellis Island, immigration, and they would determine whether you were medically fit to enter the country. If you were sick when you came to America, they turned you back. You couldn't come in. Because this meant that the German shipping company had to take you back at their own expense, something they obviously did not want to do, so the shipping companies employed doctors at the docks in Germany to determine whether you could get on the boat. They have to understand what this meant. A family comes with their 6 or 7 children. They've succeeded in raising $200 or $300. And you have to understand the life in the shtetl, in the Jewish village. They didn't have $300 rolling around on trees. This was an exorbitant amount of money for a family in those days. So they would get together the money, and they would somehow manage to get it together, and they would buy tickets, and they would make their way with all whatever few possessions they had, and they would be practically have finished off their food when they got to Germany. And there they would be at the docks with tickets to get on a boat. And the doctor would say, you can all go, except for your daughter. She's got tuberculosis. She's got trichinosis in the eye. She can't come. What do you do? And they would count the stories of families that left their children behind at the docks. Because what could they do? They were starving. Not to get on the boat and lose their tickets would mean that they were in Germany with a family of 6 children, with no food, no jobs, no money, no hope, and no way to get back home, because they couldn't pay the journey back to Eastern Europe. And there's stories, thousands of these children that got left behind. Wives separated from families who would try to work and get another ticket while they got better. Unbelievable stories. So what the Jews went through in order to get to America is quite incredible. And of course, you know, there was this legend that it was the Golden of Medina, the land of gold. But of course, reality was far different. In New York City alone, there were approximately 80,000 Jews in the census of 1890. In 1910, just before World War I, right, there were over 1.7 million Jews. In 30 years, they didn't know what to do with it. The conditions of poverty were unbelievable. So you ask a question, because of those 2 million Jews, approximately 1.2, 1.3 million of them went through Germany. Why'd they go to America? Why didn't they stay in Germany? As a matter of fact, the Habsburg dynasty and before them very much wanted the Jews to come to Germany. There was a certain myth, based on truth or not is an interesting question, that Jews were good for the economy. They were willing to grant them citizenship rights. They were willing to give them land, which was an unprecedented thing, to come stay in Germany. Why didn't the Jews come to Germany? There was almost a Jewish sense. Not there. Not here. Somehow the Jews sensed they'd been there before, in the Middle Ages. It hadn't been good for them then. It wasn't the place to end up. That sixth collective national sense is ultimately what saved the Jewish people. Because if the Jews had stayed in Germany, then we wouldn't be here, when you think about it. And if there wouldn't have been a place to go to, America, then they probably would have stayed in Germany. So on the very day that the exile was at its height, and Jews were walking across the border from Spain to a fate they knew not of what, on that same day, those three ships set sail, guaranteeing that the end of that journey, there'd be a place for Jews to go. That's an incredible commentary on history when you think about it. Now, why do I tell you all this? Because this is a very Jewish concept. This mindset. This exile and redemption all rolled up into one. Rav Yaakov Beirav sensed that the expulsion from Spain was a unique event. And he believed that the generation that had witnessed the horrors and the cruelties and the pain of the expulsion from Spain was a generation that was now worthy of redemption. And he spent his life attempting to reach this goal. That's very important. Rav Karo, Rav Yosef Karo, would become his greatest student. Now it's important to know, Rav Karo, by the way, was born in 1488. He was born in Toledo in Spain. And so he witnessed the expulsion as a boy of four. As a boy of four, as a child. And it must have had a profound effect on him, you know. I don't know if you remember anything from when you were four or five. I remember like a couple of events from when I was four and certainly from when I was five. But I once met a guy who was born in the camps and who was three at the end of the war. How he survives the story in and of himself. He came to speak at Lincoln Square Synagogue. And this is when I was... Pardon?
What did he say?
He was born in the camps in the Holocaust at eight. And he was... The war was... He was born in 1942 in the ghetto and then in the camps. He was a kid in Treblinka. So I remember he came to speak in Lincoln Square Synagogue. Talk about how what the Holocaust meant to him and who his parents were and their journey. And I walked up to him afterwards and I said, like, do you remember being in Treblinka? He looked at me and said, of course. I said, but you were 3 years old. He said, but how can you forget Treblinka? It's a very powerful message. So I imagine that even though Rav Yosef Karo was 4 years old, it must have had a powerful impact on him. He eventually made his way to Greece. And then to Turkey, eventually to Adrianople. In 1522, he began what was to become one of his greatest works. There was a great rabbi called the Tour. I won't go into, so forget these details, if you know, don't worry about it. But the Tour, Rav Yaakov ben Aturim, was the son of the Rush, Rabbeinu Asher of Toledo, Spain. He actually also went from Germany to Toledo. And Rabbeinu Asher was one of the greatest authorities in the Jewish world. And his son, Rabbeinu Yaakov, wrote a commentary on all of Halakha, on all of Jewish law, based really in part on the Rambam, Maimonides. Rav Yosef Karo wrote a commentary on this commentary. His commentary was called The House of Joseph, the Beit Yosef, because his name is Yosef. And I want you to know this is one of the most unbelievable commentaries you will ever find. Any student studying, at least traditionally within the Orthodox system, studying for the rabbinate, has to learn this commentary. And what this commentary does, imagine for the moment that the Tur mentions a halakha. And says, for example, that one should wait a certain amount of time after eating meat before eating milk. And that there may be two opinions. So the Beit Yosef's question was, well, what is this based on? And what the Beit Yosef would do, what this book would do, was to go back to the sources, to the Mishnah, to the Talmud, Maimonides, Rashi, the Ramban, all of the great authorities, tens, sometimes hundreds of them, detail all the different possibilities, all the debates, all the texts, where it comes from, and then arrive at a conclusion halachically. So that if you wanted to study not just the halacha, not just the law, but what the law was based on, what the debate was, what the different possibilities were, what the exegesis were, how we arrived at this law at the end of the 1300s from the statement that was originally written in the Talmud, and sometimes even from the verse in the Bible. So you would read the Beit Yosef. Like you can imagine, this must have been an encyclopedic work. What's quite incredible is that he finished this by the time he was 40 years old. The entire Talmud, all the commentaries, everything. In addition, and maybe I should give you just an aside, he became, when he was in Constantinople, he became very close with a guy by the name of Shlomo Alkabetz. They would have become lifelong friends. You will know Shlomo Alkabetz as the one who wrote the Lecha Dodi. Mm-hmm. And Shlomo Alkabetz actually was one of the great mystics of his day. And he eventually made his way to Tzfat, which I'll get to in a minute. Rav Yosef Karo during this time also wrote a book, which I have to tell you is one of the strangest books you will ever hear about. I tell you right now, I don't know what to do with this book. And I'm still processing what it means, but I'll tell you anyway what it is. It's a book called the Magid Meisharim. There's a tradition of Rav Yosef Karo, and he writes this in the introduction to the book, and there's a big debate, you can imagine, whether or not Rav Yosef Karo really wrote this, because it was published soon after his death, or whether perhaps other of his students published it and wrote this. It doesn't really matter to me, because the story I'm going to tell you right now, they wouldn't tell about you and me. So the fact that they tell this story, and that such a book exists, tells you something about the people's perspective of Rav Yosef Karo. The Magid Meisharim is ostensibly a book of Torah thoughts that were taught to its author by a Magid, by an angel. And there is a tradition that Rav Yosef Karo had an angel, some kind of a super mystical, spiritual creature, whatever it is, that would come to him in the night and teach him Torah, collected in a book called Magid Meisharim. For me, the most important part of this is how the people perceived the majesty, the beauty of his thoughts. As if to say, only an angel could have come up with this. It's a tremendous thought. So that's Rav Yosef Karo. A year after Rav Shlomo Alkabetz went to Tzfat, Rav Yosef Karo followed him. And Tzfat is now becoming one of the great centers of Torah Jewry. And you have to understand, after the expulsion from Spain, and the death of thousands, tens of thousands of Jews and Jewish leaders, there was a tremendous dearth of Jewish leadership. Who would take the Jews into the next generation? Where was the community that would be the center of Torah learning? You know, if you ask yourself, where's the center of Torah today? Now, if you ask this question, 75 years ago, where would the center of Torah learning be 75 years ago? Europe. Eastern Europe, sorry. Poland. If you ask the question 40 years ago, where was the center of Torah leadership 40 years ago? America. The greatest Torah scholars, the greatest yeshivot were all in New York. Today, fascinatingly enough, the Torah center leadership of the world is becoming the state of Israel. And specifically, Yerushalayim. There are more yeshivot per square foot in this city than anywhere else in the world, which is unbelievable. Thousands upon thousands of people come to study Torah now. It's like the fulfillment of some kind of an ancient prophecy. It's tremendous. But I will tell you that there are certainly more people studying Torah. I would find that hard to believe post-Holocaust. If you were to visit Poland in 1925, certainly in 1855, and see the different yeshivot and the majesty, but still, that's a good question. I'm not so sure. I will tell you that there are definitely a lot more people learning Torah today than there were 20 years ago. That I think is true. Whether that's because we're getting back to where we were is an interesting question. Tzfat is now becoming the center of Torah leadership in the world. The Ari, Yitzhak Luria, who is without par, probably the greatest Kabbalist Jewish mystic that lived in the last 500 years, is living in Tzfat and teaching Torah. And his students, some of the greatest authorities in Jewish history, Rav Chaim Vital, Shlomo Alkabetz, who I just mentioned, are living in Tzfat. Rav Yaakov Beirav has come to Tzfat, the teacher of Rav Yosef Karo. And so Rav Yosef follows his Rebbe and his friend and comes to Tzfat. Now you could only imagine, I mean, the mystical, spiritual energy. You know, I don't know, have you been to Tzfat? Okay, if you go visit Tzfat, and you should, it's an incredible place to visit. And by the way, if you go to visit Tzfat, before you go to visit Tzfat, come talk to me, and I'll give you a few things to read. Because if you're going to go, read a little so you know what you see. When you walk around Tzfat, and you see the signs, you say, well, this was the synagogue of Rav Yosef Karo, and this is the synagogue of the Ari, and this is Rav Shlomo Alkabetz, or you go to the graveyard, and you see how many great Torah scholars were. It was like a who's who of Torah. I mean, it was like you must have walked into this community and just, you know, floated as you walked in, because the energy must have been so incredible. And the books and Torah that came out of this place. It was to this place that Rav Yosef Karo came. Now, I got to give you another piece of background about Rav Yosef Karo. There's an interesting debate. I told you the other day that we lost biblical ordination. Now, it's traditionally a rabbi, as defined by the Torah, by the Bible, biblically, was someone who had received ordination, who had been ordained, as it were, on whom the title Rav, teacher, master, had been conferred by a teacher who himself was a Rav. That was biblical ordination. When we had no more Rabbanim, because they were all killed out by the Romans, we lost that. So the question arose, and this is something that's puzzled, you know, the Jewish mystics and whatever, how will biblical ordination return to the Jewish people? Because you have to understand what the problem is. Maimonides discusses at a certain point, how do I know somebody is Mashiach? Let's say somebody comes and says, I'm the Messiah. And Messiah in Judaism doesn't mean some mystical figure, it means anointed one. The one who is the legitimate king, scion of the Davidic dynasty, royal dynasty. Someone comes along, and he's appointed king, and he has a friend, and the friend says, I'm a prophet, and they make a king, and he's king. Now, if he is the king, and he's a king of King David, a descendant of King David, and if legitimately he's supposed to be the king, so if you deny his kingship, you're denying a basic truth in Judaism. And technically, biblically, you might even be liable to death. So you don't want to stand up and say, well, maybe you're not the king. On the other hand, if he's not the king, well, you know, if you try to build a temple and he's not the king, you got all sorts of other problems. So how do you know? So you could say to me, well, if there's a prophet, the prophet says, you know, because that's the definition of a prophet. You know, that's not true. There were rebellions against King David and against King Solomon and against all the kings of Israel. So you could have a rebellion, so it could be. And one of the problems is that Maimonides says that in order for someone to be Mashiach, one of the ways I know that he's Mashiach is that there's certain things that this person will accomplish. One of them is the building of the temple. If a guy says, I'm the Messiah, and he's a king, but there's still no temple, there's no Beit HaMikdash, then that'll tell you he might yet be the Messiah, but he's not right now. He's not the anointed king without a temple. Now here's another catch-22. In order to have a temple, I have to have a high court, a Sanhedrin. And a high court consists of people, I'm not being exact now, halachically, but let's say in the general terms, a high court consists of 71 people who are ordained biblically. So if I don't have biblical ordination, I can't have a temple, I can't have a Mashiach, I can't build a temple, I'm stuck. But I can't have biblical ordination because I don't have anybody to ordain anybody. How do I do that? So there were two opinions. One was the miraculous approach, and one was Maimonides. The miraculous approach, and those, the Ridbaz, many who opposed Maimonides, said, what's the big deal? There's a prophet, and his name is Elijah. And somehow the Bible seems to imply that he never died, and that he is going to return to herald the coming of the Messiah. Why is he going to return? Because he has biblical ordination. So he'll be able to ordain the Messiah, and then together they'll ordain others, they'll have a Sanhedrin, and life will be good. But that's not what the Rambam says. That's not what Maimonides say. And I have to tell you, fascinatingly enough, that I think what the Rambam is saying is much deeper. But Maimonides, in his commentary to the Mishnah, says, how will we come to ordain someone? And this is very difficult to understand, I'm not going to get too deeply into it. If all the great rabbis of their day and all their greatest students will get together, and these will comprise a group who are accepted by the entire Jewish people, because they'll be all the great rabbis, and if they will all together appoint one of their lot as the greatest amongst them, that person will be considered to have biblical ordination. That's what he says. In other words, there are a number of miracles that would have to occur here. I mean, if all the great rabbis could get together, that would be a miracle. If they could all agree on something, that would be an even bigger miracle. If all the people would then accept it, that would be a phantasmic miracle. But assuming that this happened and there was biblical ordination, what this is saying is that redemption is somehow going to come about, not from God, but from the people. Which is very interesting in light of what we're going through today. Rav Yaakov Beirav believed in this Rambam. And he believed, post-expulsion from Spain, that the time had come to do this. And so he wrote letters to all the great rabbis of his day. Let us convene in Jerusalem and have a conference. And let us bring our greatest students. And let us all agree on one person. In the end, they decided on five people who will be agreed upon us as the greatest of our students, and they will have biblical ordination. Now, Rav Yaakov Beirav, I should point out, was without a doubt pretty much the greatest sage of his generation. He was accepted by just about everybody. Tremendous Torah scholar. And many rabbis agreed. There were a few rabbis who disagreed. And the debate raged quite furiously in the Jewish community. But they had the conference, and many great rabbis came. And Rav Yaakov Beirav and this conference unanimously voted a few of the students to have biblical ordination, and one of them was Rav Yosef Karo. So eventually there was so much debate, and it threatened to split the Jewish community, that Rav Yosef Karo himself decided not to give biblical ordination, which he technically could have done, according to his teacher. He decided not to give it to the next generation because he felt that the Jews weren't ready for it. There was too much debate about it. It could only work, ordination, if it was accepted by the people. But what that means is that you're dealing with a person here who, at least according to Maimonides, may well have had biblical ordination. So that the halakha that comes from him is a halakha that comes from a person who may have had biblical ordination, which explains to you part of why this was such a powerful book. And I tell you all this to get a sense of who Rav Yosef Karo was. There was a... And this conference, by the way, was in 1538. And there were tremendous problems that they were trying to solve with this idea of biblical ordination, creating a body of Jewish leadership that would be accepted by all. The problem of agunot. You know, an aguna is a woman who doesn't know if her husband is alive or dead. That's one type of aguna. She's abandoned. That's what the word means. And she can't remarry because she doesn't know if he's dead. You can only begin to imagine what a problem this must have been in the period of time following the expulsion from Spain, where there were tens of thousands of people who disappeared. They were on the roads all over the world. And they had problems of conversos and heretics, forced conversions. Is someone who accepts a baptism, who publicly denies the Jewish God and accepts Christ, but who in their hearts really wants to remain a Jew, are they Jewish, are they not Jewish, can they marry your daughters? All sorts of difficult halachic issues that plagued their day. And Rav Yaakov Beirav felt that the events were so tumultuous, it's time, we're ready, there's a spark. It's time to come home. And it's very interesting, if you look at it historically, the birth pangs, as it were, of the return to the land of Israel occur during this period of time. Because post-expulsion, you begin to see a serious beginning of a Jewish community here in the land of Israel. Fascinating. As a matter of fact, the messianic potential of that day was so great that there was a great Jew by the name of Dan Yosef Nasi, who was given the whole city of Tveria by the Duke of Naxos. It's a whole story. It was the first time in over 1,000 years that a Jew had owned property in the land of Israel. The Jews who lived there leased it from others. And a whole city was now owned by a Jew. And so you can imagine that they thought this was like the temple was going to be built the next day. So this was the fever. This was what was going on during that time. And during this period of time, Rav Yosef Karo lived in Rome. Now I have to tell you that there are a few major books. I mentioned one of them, the Beit Yosef. There is one more I should mention, and that is the Kesef Mishnah. The Shulchan Aruch of Yosef Karo wrote a commentary on Maimonides, on the entire book of Maimonides, which he finished, according to some, before the age of 20, which is unbelievable. I mean, you heard we had a discussion about one halakha in the Rambam. We could sit here for a week and discuss that one halakha. To write a commentary on the whole work is an incredible thing. And I want you to know that if he had just written that Kesef Mishnah, which literally means a silver study, if that was all he had written, he would have been thought of as a great Torah scholar, and it would have been a legacy that would have left the Jewish people, and I'd be sitting here giving you a class, and this tremendous Torah scholar wrote the Kesef Mishnah. But that wasn't enough, and he wrote the Beit Yosef, which I mentioned before. And he had the Magid Meisharim and a few other works. And all of this, I want to tell you, pales before his final great accomplishment, and that is the code of Jewish law. There was a need for a new halachic code, for a system of law that would make it easy for Jews to be able to look up the halacha. Jews weren't Torah scholars on the level that they had been 300 years earlier. The Jews were in flux. They were moving all over the continents of the world. They didn't have the ability always to ask someone. So he wanted to create a book that would allow me very easily to look up the halacha. And he left out the major portions of halacha that Maimonides included, which were not applicable to the day, being that they were in exile. the laws of sacrifices and the laws of the temple and the laws of giving to a priest, tithing in fields in the land of Israel, etc. He made it more concise. And he based his system on the work, as I mentioned before, of the Tur, the son of the Rush. And it was based halachically on Maimonides, for the most part, because Rav Yosef Karo ruled halachically almost always like Maimonides. And he had a system of ruling. And he created his code of Jewish law. And by the way, it's interesting, the message, you can learn a lot by what a person calls their book. Right? What does it mean that we're calling this the Shulchan Aruch, which is the Hebrew name? I wrote it up there. What is a Shulchan? A table. What is a Shulchan Aruch? A set table. What Rav Yosef Taro is saying is, the Torah is a feast. But in order to appreciate the feast, you have to set the table. The table settings of the Feast of Torah, the cutlery, as it were, with which to appreciate the meat of Torah, are the details of halacha. It's a tremendous idea. Now, it may well be that because Rav Yosef Karo had this potential to reinstitute biblical ordination, to reestablish the Sanhedrin, the High Court of Jewish Law, that would allow people a repository for halacha, for Jewish law, and address for their difficulties, well, it may be that because he realized that this wasn't to be, that he wrote a book that would at least replace that temporarily. So that this book became the replacement for the High Court for the Sanhedrin. Now, how does this book work? And by the way, I should mention one more thing, and that is that there was another great commentary by the name of Rabbi Moses Isserles, the Rama. The Rama lived in Krakow, in Poland, around the same time. He was an Ashkenazic rabbi, right? Eastern Europe and Western Europe. And Rav Yosef Karo, being from Spain originally, and eventually in Tzfat, part of the Spanish Jewish community, was a Sephardic rabbi. They knew each other well, corresponded with each other. The Rama of Moshe Isserles had the same idea of Yosef Karo had, and realized the importance of writing a code of Jewish law, and he wrote such a work, and called it the Darkei Moshe, the Path of Moshe. And very interestingly enough, he based it on the Tur. And it was very much the same order, and many of the same rulings as the Shulchan Aruch. But Rav Yosef Karo's book got to the printing presses first. To his credit, the Rama, when he saw that Rav Yosef Karo had written and published a book of this nature, decided not to publish his. This is a work that took him over 20 years to write. Decided not to publish it. That's a tremendous thing. He obviously wasn't writing it so that he could have a book out. He was writing it because he felt there was a need for it. And the sense you have is that the reason he chose not to publish it was because if you had two books and they disagreed a little, instead of unifying the people around the law, you would further diversify them. However, there were certain details in the halakha that applied to Sephardic Jewry that he disagreed with for Ashkenazic Jewry, and he was clearly the leader of Ashkenazic Jewry. So he decided, instead, to write footnotes, addendums, to the laws of the Shulchan Aruch. And he wrote them in the margins, glosses on the page of the Code of Jewish Law of Rav Yosef Karo, and in fact, eventually, not long after his death, or even towards the end of the time he was alive, that's how they published it. They published the Code of Jewish Law with the addendums, the glosses of the Rama. And that's how we have published it ever since. If you open up a Code of Jewish Law, you'll find that there's a text of Hebrew of the Rav Yosef Karo, and then little script letters that are the additions, addendums, disagreements of the Rama of Rav Moshe Isserles of Ashkenaz. Now, I'm sorry, his Darkei Moshe, by the way, was actually his attempt to write a book called the Beit Yosef. He was going to write something like the Beit Yosef, like that commentary in all of the Talmud, and then saw the Beit Yosef was published, so he wrote a Darkei Moshe HaKatzar, a short version. The glosses were what happened the second time when Rav Yosef Karo then published his Shulchan Aruch. Okay. Now, I want to tell you how this works. There are four sections to the Shulchan Aruch, to the Code of Jewish Law. And it's interesting, the Shulchan Aruch begins with the laws of the morning. And it ends with the laws of Avelut, with the laws of death. In other words, it's almost as if to say that whereas Maimonides said that it was a journey to find God, Rav Yosef Karo was saying it was a journey from morning till night, from cradle to grave. And there were four sections. First of all, there is the Orach Chaim, the way of life. And this section deals with all the laws of my daily existence. The laws of blessings, the laws of prayers, the laws of Shabbat, the laws of the holidays, all the types of things that I come across regularly. Then I have a section of law called Choshen Mishpat. And the Choshen Mishpat, which is the breastplate of justice, right? Choshen was the breastplate that the high priest wore in the temple. This was the adornment of the judicial system. And these were all the laws of ethics, of laws between man and his fellow, of how to run a business and make sure you're not cheating, and how to make sure your weights are measured right, and what to do if you've stolen something, and how to return it, and all the questions of Jewish ethics. And then there was a book called Evan HaEzer, which really is about all the relationships between men and women, marital relationships, premarital relationships.
What's the translation in English?
That's a good question. Evan HaEzer means literally the rock of Lazor is to help, the rock of help, I guess you could call it. But this is the pillar of Jewish familial relationships, of the family. And these really are the laws of family. Laws of how to get married, laws of divorce, laws of levirate, what happens if a brother dies and God forbid has no children, do you have an obligation to carry on his family name, etc., etc., etc. And then the fourth section was called the Yore De'ah, to teach knowledge. And these were all the laws of Yisur V'Heter, of the forbidden and the permitted, or the permitted and the prohibited. Laws of keeping kosher, laws of Nida, of the menstrual cycle, laws of mourning, etc. Now, having said that, and there are many, many commentaries you can imagine, which I won't go into, on the code of Jewish law. The Chofetz Chaim, for example, who I mentioned this week, Rav Meir Simcha Cohen, Rav Yisrael Meir Kagan of Radin, wrote a commentary called the Mishnah Brura, the clear teaching, to clarify the issues in his day, which was the early 1900s, which has become also a major work in our day. Before him, the major work of halacha was the Arach HaShulchan, which was written by Yechiel Michal Epstein. In the end of the 1800s, he wrote something called, you know, the Code of Jewish Law is called the Shulchan Aruch, the set table. So he wrote a work called the Aruch HaShulchan, the table is set. That was his commentary. He actually, interestingly enough, he was the father. Remember I mentioned in biblical commentaries, the Torah Tamima, that there was a book that collected all the Talmudic sayings and the verses. I don't know if you remember if I mentioned that. That was of Baruch Epstein, this was his father. And interestingly enough, my wife's grandmother is an Epstein. She's the niece of that Rav Baruch Epstein and the grandniece of that Aruch HaShulchan. So when we got married, you know, there's a beautiful tradition that after the wedding, you go to something called, after the chuppah, the bridal canopy ceremony, you go to something called the yichud room. Which means that before you spend your time at the dinner and all the guests and the dancing and the pictures and everything else, you and everybody else, first you take a few moments and it's just you and your wife alone. You have to appreciate, and it's a tremendous message, and people don't realize that that's not after the wedding ceremony, that's the final stage of the wedding ceremony. In Judaism, the final stage of the wedding ceremony is that you have to realize that the focus of your life is now your spouse. There's a beautiful custom that in the yichud room, that you give each other presents. So I give my wife pearl earrings, she gave me a copy of the Aruch HaShulchan, of this work, which I used to study with. So this code of Jewish law has become the basis of our system of Jewish law. Now what I'd like to do, maybe, we have a few moments left, is to give you an example of a halakha from the Shulchan Aruch. And maybe to show you how the book works, how the page works. This is a special type of a Shulchan Aruch because it's used by rabbinical students. And it contains both on one side the Tur, which has the Beit Yosef, what I mentioned before, and the Shulchan Aruch. And this particular one is all the laws of Shabbat. Now, this is one section, just so you understand what we're talking about here, of the whole section known as Or HaChaim, right? Which is just one section of the four sections of the Code of Jewish Law. So this is only the work that deals with the laws of Shabbat. And when you're studying for rabbinical studies, one of your tests is on the laws of Shabbat, and you have to know basically this whole book and all the commentaries that are in it. Just so you get an appreciation of what... And that's just the laws of Shabbat. That's not the laws of Kashrut, and that's just the laws... So if everybody's thinking about doing rabbinical studies next year, you know... And, you know, everybody has their different systems. You can see that I got, you know, a little into this, right? I have my my color-coded system here, certain places. But anyway, this, then, is the Beit Yosef. Now, you want to understand something. You see? Can you see this? It doesn't matter if you see the words. This little box here is the text of the Tur, right? The law is based on the opinions of his father, the Rush, and of Maimonides, which is written at the end of the 1300s. This whole column here is the Beit Yosef. In other words, this is the commentary on this law here. Just so you understand what a monumental work this was. But when he finished the Beit Yosef, he realized now people knew the background of the law, but sometimes people just need to know what the law is. It's like sometimes you go to a rabbi and you have a question. You want to know, is the meat kosher? You know, it's fell in the pot and, you know, whatever, is the meat okay. Well, if you say that the pot was made of aluminum and it was just the right heat, and if you dropped it in within 24 hours, and if when you mixed it in a clockwise fashion, and if in fact when you were doing this it was in the oven and there was milk on top of the oven, and you're sitting there like, cut. What's the answer? So the Shulchan Aruch said, okay, here's the answer. Of course, somebody else wrote a commentary on the Shulchan Aruch, right? And that's the way it is, there's always more to study. But this is the Shulchan Aruch, this is the Code of Jewish Law. That's what I have in the middle. And if in fact you look in the Code of Jewish Law, you can see that there's, I don't know if you can see this, right? But there's larger print and then smaller print here. That smaller print is the Rama. That's of Moshe Isserles. And then of course you have all these different commentaries. And when you're studying this stuff, so you know, how could you study what the Code of Jewish Law says, you know, without realizing what he had said in the Beit Yosef? Because if you really want to be a rabbi, it's not enough just to know what the law says. Why does it say that? Somebody comes to you and they have a halakha question. And you know that the halakha is X. But you also know that the reason the halakha is X is because of A, B, and C. And that A, B, and C doesn't necessarily apply in this case. So that changes your whole perspective. So you can't really learn the Code of Jewish Law without learning the Beit Yosef. And you can't learn the Beit Yosef without learning the Tur. Now the Beit Yosef isn't the only opinion. There's the Bach. And the Bach disagrees with the Beit Yosef. So you have to study the Bach. And of course you can't study that without studying the Rambam, because the Beit Yosef is basing this on the Rambam, and the Rambam disagrees with the Ramban. And the Rambam and the Ramban have two different ways of interpreting Rashi. And of course this all depends on how you look at the Talmudic discussion. And the Maharal of Prague, who lived in the 1600s, said you couldn't possibly arrive at a conclusion just based on a Rambam. First you had to study the Talmud and arrive at your own conclusion. And then see how that affected your ability to understand the Rambam and Rashi, and the Rambam and the Rashi, and the Bali Tosfos, etc. And that's all just through the Beit Yosef, but then of course you have to look at Shulchan Aruch. Because the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, well, that's where it is today, in the 1500s. But of course, you can't study the Code of Jewish Law without understanding that there's a huge debate, let's say in Shabbos, between the Taz and the Magen Avraham, two commentaries who lived in the 1600s and 1700s. So, or 1500s and 1600s. And there's two different ways of understanding something that the Shulchan Aruch says. And the Taz says his way. And the Magen Avraham says his way, and then there's the Shach, and the Shach disagrees with the Taz, and of course they're debating concepts that are also elucidated by the Eliyahu Rabbah. And what about the Mishnah Berurah, and what does he have to say? And a year later, you finish the first halacha, and now you're ready to go to the second one. So, understand. Now I'll give you an example, and I don't say this, I say this on condition that you understand where I'm coming from. God forbid that anybody should interpret this in any way in a denigrating fashion, because I don't mean it that way at all. I once was, you know, I'll teach just about anywhere that anybody's willing to listen. I don't care, right? I'm willing to pay whatever price I have to pay. When I was in Pittsburgh, right? So my mother-in-law took ill, and we decided in the end we stayed there for a year. And I was offered a job, which was part of our decision, to teach in the yeshiva high school there, to do work in the synagogue. And my wife really wanted to be with her mother. She was having a very difficult year. My mother-in-law, like I said, she had cancer. Baruch Hashem, she got through it. So I stayed there for the year. And then after a while, through whatever circumstances, I started teaching in a program which was a sort of conservative reform program. And the conservative synagogue asked me if I'd be willing to come and teach kids in their synagogue, and I said sure. And then I ended up getting involved teaching once a week in the evenings a group in a reform temple, like about a half an hour away. So I would go to like the Orthodox yeshiva in the morning and the conservative synagogue in the afternoon and the reform temple at night. It was a lot of fun, right? And the atheists would come somewhere in between, right? And anyway, so, you know, from my perspective, I mean, you know, whatever people are willing to listen. So once I got asked to give a lecture here at a place called Neve Shechter, which is the conservative rabbinical school center, or one of them, here in Yerushalayim. And I don't like labels, but I'm using it so you understand the story. So, and the conservative movement is not a simple cup of tea. It's much easier to define the reform movement to a certain extent, in terms of what the reform movement agrees with and doesn't agree with, and what they believe in and what they don't believe in. The conservative movement is not so simple, because many conservative Jews don't really live up to what the conservative movement, you know, believes in. But ultimately, one of the things that probably separates the conservative and the Orthodox movement, if the Orthodox is the traditional or more traditional movement, is the question of whether the Torah is divine, and whether what Moshe has to tell us is actually divine and from Sinai word for word. It's not so simple, but let's say. So I was asked to give a lecture there, and I said, sure, you know, and I went to give a class there. And I was there a little early, and they have a beautiful Beit Midrash up on the second floor. So I was waiting, they were doing something else, so I went up to the Beit Midrash. I figured anyway that would probably be where I was going to teach. And I walk in there, and there's a girl sitting at one of the tables. You know, it was like sort of set up like a library, a few tables in the middle, and just beautiful bookcases with libraries and Sfarim and Talmud. It was like a sea, like a candy shop. And I sit down at the table in the middle, and there's a girl sitting there, and she's studying Talmud. She was actually studying, I think, a tractate of, I think it was Rosh Hashanah, but I don't remember. I was very impressed. I thought, that's wonderful. He is sitting, there's a girl, and she's studying Gemara. That's tremendous. And she sees that I'm sitting there, and I took out a sefer, and I started to learn. And, you know, sometimes you get into learning, you sort of forget where you are. You know, in the yeshiva world, so you're not just reading. You know, so I was trying to actually respond to something for a different class, and I was getting a little into it, and I said, oh, if Ravis is like this, then if you follow the Ramban, then you can't really listen to what Rava has to say, because Rava doesn't say it that way. So that's why the Ramban says it. He said, but why does Rava say it that way? So that's how you learn, like in yeshiva. So I opened my eyes for a second, I see this girl's looking at me. So I suddenly realized, like, I'm in somebody else's Beit Midrash, and, you know, I was disturbing her, and I said, oh, I'm really sorry, whatever. She says, no, I see you're, you know, you're into it, that's nice, but, you know, if you're already sitting here, you know, where you're from, whatever. She says, I have a question for you, I'm studying the Talmud here, and I have a question. So I said, sure. So she came over to me, and we were talking, and she was, you know, it was clear that she hadn't studied that much Talmud, and she was having difficulty reading some of the Aramaic, and one of her questions was based on how you interpret a certain word. And I said to her after a while, you know, I think this is so wonderful. You're sitting here, you're studying Gemara and Yerushalayim. It's so tremendous, you know, two people we never met before, we can sit and study Talmud. That's tremendous. So I said, what are you doing? So she said, well, actually, I'm in my last year of rabbinical school. I'm going to be a rabbi next year. And I want you to know, my heart just sunk. Because on the one hand, if a person wants to become a rabbi, that's such a wonderful thing. And for the moment, it doesn't matter to me, man, woman, how to be, not to be, that's not the issue for me. Somebody wants to teach Torah to other people. Somebody wants to study Torah and become more rooted in their Jewish heritage. That's a tremendous thing. That's magnificent. But the other half of me said, here's a person who's going to become a rabbi and lead a congregation. She doesn't know how to read a line of Talmud. There's so much that she's missing. And I just had this tremendous desire to be able to share it all with her in that afternoon, but of course I couldn't. There's so much here. It's such a sea. And you can get lost in it to a certain extent, but there's such a beauty to it. And I want to tell you, you look at the power of Jewish questions. I mentioned to you once, when we were talking about the value of a question, I mentioned to you the Mima Makiv. Do you remember? Rav Ephraim Mashri, who wrote a book. Did I mention this to you? Rav Ephraim Mashri was the last rabbi of the ghetto of Kovno. At the beginning, when the Nazis came into Lithuania, came into Kovno, so they didn't right away ship people off. They wanted to first give the illusion of being understanding, you know. And they had a gradual process. I've told you before that, you know, in order for something to be real and successful, it should be gradual. You can't go from A to Z. You can't go from 0 to 60 in a second. Unfortunately, it's true not only with the positive, but with the negative. The Nazis' success was very often based on the fact that they did it gradually. They didn't take you off the train and right, you know, and just begin shooting. They took you through a whole process that was designed to gradually bring you to where they wanted you to be psychologically. They did the same thing in the ghetto. So at the beginning, when they were rounding up Jews, they couldn't round up a rabbiner or a rabbi who was in his 50s or whatever it was, who was getting on, and make him, you know, pave streets, because it was too risky in terms of how that would affect the Jewish community. Don't forget, Lithuania hadn't had years to get used to the Nazis like the Germans had. They didn't want to create a revolt, and they didn't want Jews to start running away. But on the other hand, it seems, from what I've seen and read about this, that the thought of a Jew walking around with no hard labor and nothing to do, they couldn't stomach that. So they had to find him a job. So they found a warehouse, and they made him the guard of the warehouse, and they got him like a little uniform, he described this, and a little, if I'm not mistaken, like a Keystone Cop type of hat. And he had to stand with this belt and this ridiculous looking outfit in front of this warehouse. And the Nazis would walk by and laugh. Gave them pleasure to see this old rabbi who was forced to be a watchman in front of the warehouse. Now after a month or so, he started to wonder what was in this warehouse that all these important officials kept going in and out of. So he walked in, and he discovered that he was guarding a warehouse of Jewish treasure. It was one of the key offloading areas for Jewish looted treasure that was going to eventually be cataloged and shipped for the Museum of the Extinct Jewish Race that Adolf Hitler wanted to establish in Berlin. Most importantly, in this warehouse of Jewish treasure, there were thousands upon thousands of Jewish books. Svarim. In other words, what the Nazis had done is they'd taken a great Torah scholar and they'd given him a library. Now word spread and the people started to come to him. He was already the Rav of Kovno with their questions. And the questions that they asked are amazing. They're incredible. Even if you don't know the answer, they're just unbelievable questions. Is a woman allowed to have an abortion? The Nazis forbade a woman to get pregnant, a Jewish woman to get pregnant. If they caught a Jewish woman pregnant, they would shoot her in the stomach, killing her and her fetus on the spot. There was no guarantee a Nazi would find you. If you had an abortion, you were killing the baby inside of you. So could you have an abortion to save your life potentially? So the answer isn't the issue. And the answer was yes, but the answer isn't an issue. The question is incredible. What do you do? Can you make a Seder on 4 cups of water? What blessing do you make when you eat on Yom Kippur? If you're walking in a death march and a Jew falls by the side of the road, are you allowed to run out of the line to try to pick him up? If you don't, you know that within a matter of moments a guard will spot him and he'll be dead. If you do, you're putting your life in danger. Are you allowed to put your life in danger to save another life? Not so simple. And the questions are unbelievable. And he wrote, he collected these questions and he gave answers and he wrote down little scraps of paper what his questions were and what his answers were and hid them, buried under the ground in little tin cans. And he came back, he survived the war and the camps, and he came back and after the war he published them and called them Mimam Akim, from the depths. An incredible five-volume set. There is incidentally a one-volume English synopsis of these questions and their answers without going into all the halachic detail. So I learned a lot of these tshuvot, these responses. He was in South Africa for a while after the war. And my father-in-law actually met him. But I read some of these tshuvot. And the halachic detail, he was brilliant. I mean, they found, in the ghetto, they found a lulav, you know, a palm branch, that had been left somewhere on top of the ark from the previous year of Sukkot. And they wanted to know if they could use it. It was all dried up. Could you make a blessing on it? Could you make a blessing on a lulav if you didn't have the other three species for the Feast of Tabernacles? And he goes into a whole discussion. And what is a lulav and what's the blessing and what does it mean? And is it a function of having four, the four different species represent four different types of individuals? And bonding them together represents the unity of the Jewish people. Are you missing that idea if you only have one? Or does each individual count? And he's going into all the details of this question. What a lulav is, where we learn it, and what the different possibilities are, and what the version of the blessing is, and you catch yourself saying while you're reading this, wait a second, what's wrong with this person? He's in the Kovno ghetto. He's going to be deported any day to Auschwitz. And they're worrying about the blessing for a lulav? What's wrong with these people? They want to know how to eat on Yom Kippur? Is it considered an act of eating if you eat such a small amount that you can't taste it? So should you take little bits of food every X amount of time? And should you then make a blessing? And if you do make a blessing, do you make a blessing afterwards? Yerushalayim! Well, what's going on here? In fact, if you look at the story of Jewish exile and you look at this book, you think there's something wrong with these people. I mean, they're being expelled from Spain and they're wondering about how to bring the Messiah? I mean, are they mad? And yet you get a sense, when you start to learn halacha, that this is really the oxygen of the Jewish people. That a Jew can live without a home. A Jew can live without a library. A Jew can live with just the clothes on his back. just as a Jew has learned to live with the whip. But a Jew can't live without the Torah. And when Jews were running out of synagogues that were burning, they left behind the silver hands and the wine goblets and the clothes and the possessions, and they grabbed the Torah scrolls. Because that's what this meant to the Jewish people. And if ultimately this halakha is based on a system which began so many thousands of years ago at Mount Sinai, then ultimately what Hashem seems to have been telling the Jewish people is, I'm going to give you something which will be your life jacket. Wear this with you wherever you go, even when you don't understand it. Because this is how you will survive in the raging torrent of the sea. That's the power of the Shulchan Aruch. That's the code of Jewish law. That's why this book became a part of every Jewish home. You go to a Jewish home, it has a mezuzah, has a Bible, and has a Shulchan Aruch. Tremendous idea. And that was Rav Yosef Karo. And I would venture to say that if Rav Yosef Karo wrote this because he believed that without a high court, the Jewish people needed a system, and he believed that somehow they were living in an era that would bring them closer to redemption, it's clear that that's exactly what this book did. Because this attention to detail, these laws, these mitzvot, the beauty of halacha, the phenomenon of a Jew clinging to the detail, is the reason ultimately that we're still here. So that's food for thought. And I hope I whet your appetite a little. You can actually find portions of this translated into English, including the Chafetz Chaim's commentary called the Mishnah Berurah, which is translated today into English. And halacha really is something to study at the right time and the right place. But at least that a person walking through a Jewish institution should walk out and should be able to say, I know what the Shulchan Aruch is. I think that's something worthwhile. And what you do with it is up to you. And I want to say one last thing, because even though we're going to do some more studying in the Jewish ethics course, this really concludes our class, or our series of classes in Jewish books. So I want to just end with a bracha. I want to give you there's a Jewish custom that when Jews get together, when they meet, Jews should give each other blessings. It's a beautiful custom. Rav Shlomo Kalach was very into this. So I want to give you a blessing. I remember once, this was 2, 3, 4 years ago, and I was learning late at night. You've gotten a taste of what I do here. So to find time to learn on my own when it's quiet and the phone isn't ringing and I'm not learning to prepare for a class, but just learning for me, just to enjoy the learning, it's not easy to do. So I had to do it early in the morning or late at night. So I was sitting one night and I was learning and I was getting into something, whatever, and I love to learn. And my daughter came downstairs. And she was like, you know, my daughter, when she wakes up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom, get a cup of water, she's like in another stratosphere. Like, she'll get out of her bed, and she knows the bathroom is here, but she's sleeping. And she'll just kind of like walk around, like, you know, end up walking towards the stair, and I'll see her there, like, Miami, you want to go to the bathroom? Right? And she'll just go, and you'll put her in the bathroom, and she'll sit in the bathroom, and then she'll go back, right? And it'll say, good night, and back to bed. So she comes wandering downstairs at like 1:30 in the morning. And I'm sitting downstairs learning, and I've got some music on, whatever. And she comes and says, and you know, sometimes you become like aware of something before you actually see it. And then you can sense, like if somebody's watching you. So she comes down and says, and she sits down at the bottom of the stairs. Mm-hmm. And she's sort of in that nether state of not really asleep, but not really awake. And she's kind of like rubbing her eyes, looking around her, right? All of a sudden, I hear, what are you doing, Abba? You know, what are you doing? So I turn around and see my aunt. So what's your, you know, you just want to go and hug him, you know? So I walk over to give my daughter a hug and to pick her up and take her back to bed. And she says, again, what are you doing? So I said, I'm learning, you know. And I put her back into bed. And I went back downstairs to learn. And sometimes you don't appreciate something. It takes a while for it to sink in, you know. It took me about a half an hour. And all of a sudden it hit me. Like, my daughter came downstairs in the middle of the night. And she found her father learning Torah. Mm-hmm. She didn't find me watching TV. Mm-hmm. She didn't find me doing push-ups. She didn't find me, you know, reading a Kierkegaard novel. She's family learning Torah. And when I stopped to think about it, that was what I had always hoped that my child, that if they would come down in the middle of the night, that they would find their father learning Torah. So that's the bracha I give you. It's a beautiful thing to develop a relationship with Jewish books. It's a wonderful thing. And if you have had your appetite whetted. I don't know if that's right, but it sounds right. And because of that, you discover this beauty, so that someday you can pass it on to your children. Then yours is the earth. Food for thought. Until Bezrat Hashem next time. And it was really a pleasure.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.